Well, we're at Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor and have the pleasure of talking with renowned environmentalist and author Bill McKibben, who just spoke to a packed house. Title of his presentation, Down to the Wire, A Hot Fight in a Hot World. Bill's also the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College and a leader of the anti-carbon campaign group 350.org, the first planet-wide grassroots climate change movement. Bill, a pleasure.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
You mentioned that over the last 25 years or so, we really haven't been in an argument, although that's sort of about climate and climate change. We've really been in a battle, in a fight, and that fight continues. Clarify that a little bit.
I used to think that we were having an argument about climate change, and if we just wrote more books, eventually our leaders would be persuaded and so on. But that's not true. The argument ended a long time ago. Science is very clear about what's going on. Indeed, we now know from leaked documents and things that even the oil companies 30 years ago knew everything there was to know about climate change. But they spent a lot of money staging this sham debate because they didn't want to change anything that they were doing, and they figured the best thing to do was throw as much chum in the water as they could, just muddy the waters, and what do you know, they've succeeded so well that we now end up with a president who thinks climate change was invented by the Chinese. I mean, it's been a sham debate, and while we've been debating, the ice caps have been melting, the ocean's been acidifying, the temperature's been rising.
One of the successes in taking the strategy that they did, they succeeded in politicizing what is essentially a scientific argument.
Exactly right. I mean, if you think about it, most questions that we face are at some level political. They're about controversies between different groups of people. I want to pay fewer taxes, you want more services, whatever. So the right way to do them is to have a kind of political process, and you meet someplace in the middle and you come back 5 years and fight again and so on and so forth. That's not what this is at bottom. At bottom, this is a debate between human beings on the one hand and physics on the other. That's a tough debate. Physics, uninterested in compromise, does not spin, doesn't care that we're in a rough economic moment, whatever it is. Physics just sets the rules.
This fight is being taken to the grassroots level. Environmentalists all over the world, not just 350.org, but everywhere, are becoming increasingly engaged, and you see that as the great hope.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to somehow match the power of the fossil fuel industry. Their power is rooted in money. We're obviously not going to win that battle, so our power has to be rooted in people, in passion, spirit, creativity, and all the things that mark movements. And that's why it's beginning to everywhere win. That and the fact that the engineers have done their job so well that the alternative future is clear. We could be running this show on sun and wind, and we should be.
Bill, one of the more compelling, most compelling things about your presentation were some of the slides that you showed from all across the globe. People out there, 350.org, talking about parts per million, in some of the countries like Yemen, where you might least expect something like that.
We think we've organized about 20,000 rallies. The only country we haven't been able ever to get to is North Korea. I'm not sure we really want to try. But other than that, people everywhere. And here's the thing. Many of them in countries that have done nothing to cause this problem. And whenever I get feeling lazy or burnt out, I just think, well, if people in places that didn't cause the problem can rally to be part of the solution, then by gum, so can we.
You mentioned in your speech your good friend and, I guess, neighbor in Vermont, Bernie Sanders. You guys have been friends for a long time. I would assume you didn't say this, that you were a strong supporter of his during the recent campaign. But when you see what happened, I mean, it is hard sometimes to be anything less than cynical given what the Trump administration is trying to do with environmental protection.
Yes, they're doing great, great damage. The Koch brothers are getting all their dreams that they've paid for over the years. They're coming to reality right now, and it's very sad to watch the work of many people over many decades being undone on behalf of the greediest and dirtiest people in the country. I take a little bit of satisfaction in the fact that Bernie remains the most popular politician in America. So that gives me some hope that people really want solutions if we can just figure out how to get past the dead weight of the 1%.
I'm talking with noted environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. Bill, you said, though, you took us through sort of a hierarchy of activism, starting with signing of petitions and moving up the scale. You said that this activism, though, is at its roots fundamentally conservative, not radical. I'd like our listeners to hear your rationale for that.
So I've been off to jail a number of times, and so sometimes people say, well, you must be a radical. But, of course, all we're asking for is a world a little bit like the one that we were born onto, a world where there's a little ice at the north and the south and some coral reefs left in the middle and, you know, a world where we still have winter. And that's not a radical demand. That's a deeply conservative demand. I was saying before, I think radicals work at all companies. And if you're willing to go alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere, and you're willing to do it once you've seen that it's melting the poles, then you're engaged. That's some heavy-duty, no-kidding radicalism that you're engaged in.
You know, back to the data that Exxon has had for all these years about the impact of carbon in the atmosphere and climate change. In all of my years of following environmental activism, I mean, I thought I'd seen it all. But when those revelations came out, I mean, I have to tell you that, I mean, that was beyond my worst expectations of cynicism.
I completely agree. I mean, it's hard to imagine how much damage they did simply by not telling the truth. If Exxon had just said in 1989, after Jim Hansen had testified before Congress, if they just said, yeah, you know what, our scientists are finding just the same thing, then nobody would have said, well, Exxon's being a climate alarmist. You know, everyone would have said, okay, this is bad news because we depend on fossil fuel, but I guess we better get straight to work figuring out how not to depend on fossil fuel. We would not have solved the problem by now. We'd be well on the way to solving the problem.
Well, if they knew all of this well ahead of time, why weren't they more aggressive in buying up wind, solar, alternative energy, renewable energy, infrastructure, et cetera?
I mean, it's such a good and obvious question. Exxon could have owned the solar industry. They had plenty of cash on hand, you know. I think the reason they didn't is because though you could make a lot of money putting up solar panels everywhere, you couldn't make as much money as you can with oil. And the reason is, once the panel's on the roof, the sun comes for free. Exxon doesn't like that. Exxon likes to set up a situation where they have to pull their truck up to your house every month for the rest of your life, and you have to write them a check. Okay? That's a better business model. They don't like, I mean, you know, I suppose that if we could figure out some way to let Exxon buy the sun and charge us for it, then they'd probably be willing to go ahead and do solar panels all they wanted.
Let's turn to Michigan. You talked a little bit about Enbridge Line 5. We've discussed that quite a bit on this program. One of our largest utilities, just 2 or 3 months ago, and we interviewed the CEO of DTE Energy, announced that they're going to be they're going to have no more coal-fired plants by 2050, I believe, and the portfolio is going to be roughly 40% renewable, 40% natural gas, 20% nuclear. Not good enough?
We got to get off fossil fuel long before 2050. You know, by 2050, 2060, 2070, we're going to run the whole world, obviously, on renewable energy because it's cheap. And the question is, are we going to do it by 2030? Because that's what we need to do in order to avoid having a broken planet. I don't actually want a planet for my daughter and granddaughter that's filled with solar panels and windmills, but it's also, like, too hot to live on. I want to do this in time to actually keep the worst from happening. Things are changing very, very fast. There's no two ways about it. When I started writing about this 30 years ago, when I wrote the first book about it, it was still pretty abstract and theoretical. No more.
I want to ask you about your first novel. It's called Radio Free Vermont, A Fable of Resistance. Tell us about that. Why the novel after all the other books?
Because I'm so tired of just being depressing all the time. So this is a kind of funny, book about my state of Vermont seceding from the Union, and it's mostly about how to resist, which is something I think about a lot.
Well, I've been talking, and it's been a real pleasure talking with Bill McKibben. He was recently at the Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor. He gave the Peter Wege Lecture on Sustainability. The lecture was entitled Down to the Wire, A Hot Fight in a Hot World. Let's keep the hot fight going.
Thank you guys very much.